Hi, this is Doug Jones, Abe Sapien from the Hellboy movies and the Silver Surfer from the Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, fans of the spandex set. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, where once again, I will be sitting down with an incredible talent who brings comic books to life. This week, it's Doug Jones. Now, this particular interview hits pretty close to home. Literally, I got to hang out with Doug at my local comic book shop, Pack Rat Comics, right here in Columbus, Ohio. It was part of Free Comic Book Day, one of my favorite days of the year. I can't think of a better way to be able to spend it than with the Silver Surfer himself. Now, a lot of actors and actresses are chameleons, completely adept at blending into the various roles they take on. Doug definitely takes that concept to another level. He's appeared in a bunch of your favorite sci-fi, fantasy, comic book, horror films, and TV shows, and he's currently starring in the Steven Spielberg-produced sci-fi drama on TNT, Falling Skies. Even though he's been in so many projects, you might not recognize him right away, as he often takes on quite a different appearance on set. Check this out, and I'll be right back to talk with Doug Jones. Doug Jones was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. This Hoosier graduated from David Letterman's alma mater, Ball State University, and quickly realized that mastery over physical space could lead to a lot of roles in Tinseltown. As a mime and a contortionist, yes, he's heard all the mime jokes and even cracked a few himself, Doug tapped into a steady stream of commercial work early on, including 27 spots as the piano-playing, moon-shaped crooner Mac Tonight for McDonald's. If you watch any amount of television or movies, chances are you've seen and loved Doug's work. Music videos with Madonna and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Billy Butcherson from Hocus Pocus, a menacing Morlock in The Time Machine, a terrifying clown going toe-to-toe with Michael Keaton's Batman in Batman Returns, Pan in director Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, the amphibious man Abe Sapien in del Toro's adaptations of Mike Mignola's Hellboy comic book, and Doug sailed across the silver screen as the Sentinel of the Spaceways, the Silver Surfer, in Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. And Doug has even stepped out from under the makeup and prosthetics on occasion in projects like the TV series Criminal Minds and the feature film My Name is Jerry in the title role, which was written specifically for him. Now joining me today is an actor, a singer, a writer who's appeared in many of your favorite sci-fi, fantasy, and horror films and TV shows. He's the man of a thousand faces, the modern day Lon Chaney. He is Doug Jones.
Wow.
Doug, welcome to Comic Book Central.
That's an introduction I cannot live up to, but thank you.
We'll spend a little time and see if you can live up to it. And welcome to Columbus, Ohio. Is this your first trip
no,
here?
No, I've been here several times for Mid-OhioCon. Then it was taken over by Wizard World, Mid-OhioCon, and then it's my fourth official trip here.
Okay. So you're making some regular, and you're a Midwesterner,
I came from Indianapolis, Indiana, so that's why this region of the country feels like my peeps, you know, these are my people.
You're back home now.
I do, very much.
Well, it's good to have you here, too. And for Free Comic Book Day, what better way to...
Yeah, which I've never done a Free Comic Book Day event before.
Okay.
I've heard that phrase come up a lot, and I didn't really know what it was, and now it's been all explained to me. I've been learned up on it. And to be at a comic book store in the Midwest and seeing the parking lot fill up with lines of people and activities, I didn't know the publishers got in on this, and the retailers, it's just a great coming together of everyone celebrating the world of comic books.
What did you expect? Because if somebody says, okay, it's Doug Jones, you're going to be here in Columbus, Ohio, and it's Free Comic Book Day, what's kind of going through your mind?
Like my mind.
Like, do you have to give out free?
No, you're right. I don't have a comic book to give away. No, but I thought, okay, if I have a table of, like, you know, with my 8x10s on it, and like, here I am, Doug Jones. I thought the people are going to be coming here to get their free comic books, and they're going to turn around and go back to the car, and I'll be sitting there going, cricket, cricket. And it was quite the opposite. I had, I thought it was just a nice, steady stream of people coming in. They were very nice, very lovely. And then I talk a lot with people at my table, and I get up and I hug them, I take pictures with them, and whatever.
I did notice, because I was here yesterday, and it was for
a lot of people listening to this podcast go to these comic conventions. And sometimes you get the attention of the celebrities and sometimes you don't. So it's you were like making moments for each one. It's like you were spending quality time with them and interacting. And I was just amazed by that. I mean, what sort of spurs you on to do that? Is it just like when you see the fans there and just their passion for your projects? Because there's a ton of projects you've done.
Well, there are. And I think if I'm at a table and there's a line of people waiting to meet me, there was a line outside that I didn't see. So I was taking all this time with people. And finally, I was told, like, you know, there's 30 people outside. I'm like, no. So I had to move it along a little faster. But if there's a line of people that are waiting to see me, that means that they've watched my movies and TV shows I've been on, and those are the people that help buy my house for me. So and they've come out to see me today. So that means I want to hug on them and thank them for, you know, I wouldn't have a job without them. So yeah. I don't feel that they owe me anything. They've already given me so much that I like to come out and meet them and. I can put those faces behind the camera the next job I do too. So every time I see, you know, I'm on a big set and I see those cameras, that kind of inspires me if I'm having if I'm low on energy or I'm kind of like at the end of a long day, an 18-hour day, and I put those rabid happy faces behind that lens, and it's like, okay, that's who I'm doing this for. And this kind of event reminds me of that.
You know, they're in the lines, they're grabbing their popcorn, they're going to be watching something, they're going to be thinking of you. So, yeah, go to a convention appearance where Doug Jones is. He'll hug you.
That's right. I got several more coming up this year, too. Yeah.
How old were you when you first got interested in show business?
Oh, goodness. I, as long as I can remember, I was an awkward child. You'll hear a lot of people in showbiz say that. Start their story with, I was a weird kid. But being as tall as I am and as skinny as I am and always have been, growing up in Indiana, if you're a Midwestern kid, there's a certain sliver of right to fit in. If you don't, you'll be made fun of. You know, it's kind of the rules of the playground. So I was made fun of relentlessly. And so in order to, deal with that, get over that, I had to develop a sense of humor. So I decided I will control when the laughs happen instead of just being laughed at. I will do something funny that will cause laughter. Now that makes sense to me. So I became a bit of a performer and a class clown.
Was it to disarm? I mean, was there bullying involved or anything? Or was it to disarm people before they had a chance?
Yeah,
to
I think
to
so. Kind of yeah, absolutely, yes. Okay. My really good friends were all the people that I was watching on TV at the time. I didn't watch kids programming. I watched sitcoms. I watched The Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore and Barney Fife was a big inspiration for me on the Mayberry Show and Gilligan on Gilligan's Island, Gomer on Gomer Pyle, like goofy characters that actually were the centerpiece of a show. Was like, wow, if they can be important and doing something with their lives, so can I.
So you kind of embrace the physicality of their roles.
Absolutely. And Jerry Lewis, another big one, watching his movies with Dean Martin, you know, as the goofy sidekick. Yeah, that was a role that I took on in my real life, and I thought, well, if they can make a career out of it, then maybe there's hope. There's an option.
Well, 60s and 70s TV, I mean, it was just nothing but physical comedy. I mean, you had
so
like
much
Carol
slapstick.
You had all these like
Carol
Burnett shows.
Yes,
that it just was crazy. You had all the Mel Brooks stuff coming
right,
out. You know,
right.
Just it was like so broad.
I was a variety show junkie too. I never missed like Donny Marie, Sonny and Cher. Everybody had a
pretty
had
much
a,
variety show.
I watched it all. Yeah.
Now, so is that where? Like, when did you decide? Okay, being a contortionist, because that was early on coming in. Like, when did you realize that your body could do like what Plastic Man and
Yeah? I didn't decide to be a contortionist. I realized I was one. I think that's what you have
your
to
DNA.
Do. Yeah. Just because positions I would sit in that were comfortable for me, just watching TV, and my three older brothers would be like, "What is that? Wait, you look weird sitting like that." I'm like, "Really? That looks weird to you?" Because I'm totally comfortable. Well, let's see how much farther I can go. Oh, don't stop doing that. I would end up with my legs behind my head, and that's how I figured out I could do it.
So, I mean, how did that translate? Because then early on, too, you were a mime.
Yeah.
So how did those sort of impact what you did later? Like, did you kind of look at these things and go, can I make money at this?
Well, it goes,
or can I do something else?
It goes on your acting resume as a special skill. Right? So at the bottom of your resume, you have special skills. And then, when mime and contortionist show up on there, then that makes people go, huh, well, can you show us a little something? And so auditions were always fun for me when I was starting off as an actor. And so you would throw I'd throw my leg behind my head or twist up on the floor for them and be like, oh, wow, well, that's it. Oh. So I even was I guested on a few sitcoms and whatnot early in my career that and they would might actually rewrite something in for me to do a physical gag because they knew that now that I could. So you know, and I booked a lot of silly commercials that had sight gags built into them. They didn't know exactly what they wanted, but they wanted something funny to happen at this part of the commercial. And then during the casting process, they see what people can do, and they're like, "Oh, get that tall, skinny guy to put his legs behind his head. That's funny.
It's something different. We'll figure out how to use it later."
Exactly. Yeah. So that happened a lot. The contortion thing. I never had a contortionist act that I've traveled with the circus. I never practiced or developed anything. I'm a one trick pony. I can put my legs behind my head. Ta da! And I'm shocked
at Tales by the Crypt, though. Didn't you play a contortionist in Tales by the Crypt? Tales
from the Crypt. I got that job because of twisting up in a casting office. Exactly. It was like a circus themed episode with Ernie Hudson.
What do you look for in acting roles? Because you did a lot of commercial work and things. So as you're coming into this area, what were you sort of looking for?
When you're starting, you're looking for anything that pays, right? So I was a bit of a whore, and if they pay, I'd be there. Now that I can be more picky, I realize what I love, and I love story. I love a story that inspires or educates or entertains. I love laughing. I love laughing and crying. I love it all. And if a story gives you chilling fear to the core of your being. But with some kind of redemptive meaning to it all, that's the kind of story I love. So what I don't love is horror for the sake of blood on the wall. And I get offered a lot of those, and so those are the ones that I'll be turning down. Is that typical? Oh, we're a bunch of naked teenagers in the woods having sex and smoking pot, and oh, here comes Doug Jones to kill all of us one at a time. That's the
Somebody
story.
Somebody has to die for these acts.
I don't care for that story at all, and it's told over and over again. It's really a boring story to me. So I love stories that have. I love fantasy element, but I also just love anything that helps us relate to each other as humans. That's number one, is a story I want to help tell. Number two would be the character. Is it a character I want to invite into my soul to play through me? And then I want to feel safe doing that, and I want to also learn something and be inspired. And playing a character for me is like inviting someone over for dinner. When you open up your front door and invite someone in, you want to trust them, you want to know them, and so that's what I want to do with my characters too. And then the third thing for me is, who am I going to be directed by? Whose hands am I going to be in? Is it safe? Is it will it be a quality piece of work, or are we going to end up with bad editing choices and disastrous camera setups and all that? Because that happens too, unfortunately. But if you're with a quality filmmaker, that's great. And then a fourth thing could be, what other actors do I get to play with? Are there other, name people that I've been wanting to work with for years and I get to now? That's always a deciding factor as well, that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, one of the podcasts that I'm on, in addition to being on Comic Book Central, is the IndieCast. Mm-hmm. It's an Indiana Jones podcast. So I have to ask you about one of your early roles. How did you get involved in the world of Indiana Jones?
The Young Indiana Jones
Chronicles.
Right.
This is on Indiana Jones and the Hollywood
and the
Follies.
Hollywood Follies, right. And I think that's when the Young Indiana Jones TV series had moved into doing movies of the week kind of a thing. So it was more of a TV movie, I think.
Yeah, season three was all TV movie, 2-hour TV movie.
Right, there you go. Yeah. So the Hollywood Follies was one of those. And Young Indy was sent out to Hollywood to do, to investigate some and go on a caper. And it was a bit, in the silent movie era. All I remember from that episode was
a slapstick actor.
I was a slapstick actor, right? So, Young Indy comes walking into a studio, back in that era of filmmaking, they would have a big warehouse soundstage with many movies being shot at the same time, and they didn't have to worry about one movie's sound leaking into another. They could film them right next door to each other because they were silent movies. He walked past one set after another, and that was the kind of the sight gag, was going from a Western to a Charlie Chaplin-y kind of film, and they're all like one wall away from each other. He walked past all these different sets, so he gets to ours, and it was a typical slapstick. We were in a bakery with flour flying and dough flying all around, and somebody hitting someone else with a rolling pin and taking pratfalls, and it was hilarious fun, but it was just a sight gag for that all of us were hired to do to create this old slapstick comedy movie scene that young Indy walked past and stopped and looked at us for a minute.
Did you get to work with George Lucas at all? I mean, was he involved in
no,
that?
Not personally. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, he wasn't on the set.
I'm sure he saw
the
dailies.
Casting process or anything like that. No. Are you an Indiana Jones fan? I mean, at the time, like, were you like,
Indiana
Jones?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, who wasn't? You know, when those movies came out, they were so different than anything else any of us had seen before. It took action to a new level that brought so much personality to it and so much humor. And Harrison Ford, you know, who else could play it but him? And, you know, of course. And plus, my name is Jones, and I'm from Indiana. So there was a tie-in.
Obviously. What did you think of the television series itself, Young Indiana Jones, and how that tied into the sort of Indiana Jones mythos?
Good. You know, I didn't follow. I saw episodes here and there. I didn't follow the show religiously. So, whenever someone does like a backstory or, you know, the days before the movie, when a franchise is really popular and they try to get, you know, the before or the after parts and prequels or sequels, it always fills in information that you want to have, I think. You know, and it was nice to catch up on where Indy might have started out and how he might have been. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm sure we're going to get Indy 5 coming up, so maybe Doug Jones will go back into the world of Indiana Jones as some type of creature at the end or something. I hope maybe Indy's wacky sidekick.
Indy's wacky sidekick. I'd like. I'm getting to an age now too, where I'm playing a lot of scientific doctors and that kind of thing with lots of smart guy dialogue. So he could always use one of those sidekicks.
Goes into Austria or something like that.
Okay.
All of a sudden meets up with his compatriot there. That'd be kind of cool.
Right.
Let's talk about some of the comic book projects that you worked on. I mean, there's Tank Girl, Mystery Men, Men in Black 2. One of my favorites, Batman Returns.
Yeah, me too. Yes.
Tell our listeners your character in that, and you do get to interact with Batman a little bit. Keaton. It's a little confrontational.
Yes. I played the thin clown in the Red Triangle Circus gang that Danny DeVito as Penguin hung out with. So we were his kind of Danny DeVito's henchman sidekicks. And I showed up in maybe like six scenes in the movie. I was on the shoot for about 14 weeks. And that was my first big studio production that I had like an actual credit in, where I wasn't an extra for the first time. And I had such a great time. And again, my contortion skills got me that job. I went into I had a friend who was in the stunt department, and he told the stunt coordinator, "Well, like, I know this guy. It's a circus theme. He's hanging out with. Well, I have a contortionist I know. So, let's meet him." So I went in just thinking they wanted me for a sight gag for like a one day shoot or something. And so I twisted up and turned up, put my elbows at places they didn't belong and whatnot for the stunt coordinator. And he's like, "Oh, that looks great. Well, hang on here. I want to bring in something else, somebody else." So in comes Tim Burton with him.
Nice.
And I was like, "Whoa!" So I wet myself. And then the stunt coordinator said, "Well, do what you just did for me, for Tim." It's like, da 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 da, waka waka waka. I put my legs where, places. And Tim's like, "Wow, that's, great." So stay here. We're going to walk into the next room and talk about you. So they left me alone in this office at Warner Brothers lot. And I'm kind of going, tick-tock, looking at my nervous, the most nervous 2 minutes of my life. They come back in, and Tim Burton says, "Well, congratulations, you got the part." And I'm thinking, the part? I was just here for a sight gag. What's the part? Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Well, the thin clown.
Yeah. You think, like, in the back, like, furiously rewriting. Yeah, things, yeah. Get this guy in here. He's going to do, like, things in the
book. Right. Yeah. But the Red Triangle Circus gang had a gaggle of the poodle lady, the knife thrower dame, the tattooed lady, the sword swallower, a lot of carnies, and there was a fat clown and a thin clown that were paired up together. So the fat clown was played by Travis McKenna. He was my height and like 400 pounds, and I'm my height and 140 pounds. So we looked hilarious together. So we were paired up through most of those scenes as well, and it was my responsibility to be kind of the leader of that little caper we were pulling off when we rewired the Batmobile, and I put the homing device into where we could remote control, make the Batmobile go haywire. So that scene was a fun one for me.
Sets when you go in, I mean, obviously they're doing some CGI, but not like to the level we see today.
No.
Sets had to just be
mind
blowing.
Early 90s, and they were mind blowing. They built everything, and downtown Gotham City was on a soundstage on this huge, on the Warner Brothers lot. And it was it was wintertime. It was Christmas. It was a Christmas. The lighting of the Christmas tree was a big ceremony where we all came out of bursting out of that package, that humongous giant package Christmas present that was wheeled into downtown. Well, that was all indoors, and in order to get everybody's wearing winter overcoats, and we're filming like during the summertime in the fall of 1991 and then early 92 into January. So, but it's in California, so it wasn't cold enough to wear like furry coats. So they had they had special air conditioner units brought into that soundstage to pump air. Yeah, so it was a meat locker. This entire humongous, oversized soundstage was you could hang meat in there and it wouldn't rot. So that way they could get like steam coming off of our breath and all that kind of thing. So it looked like we were outside in the wintertime in a Southern California soundstage. So it was really, really Tim Burton, and he's a genius. He's just a genius. It was such a fun shoot. And yet, very actiony and very comic booky. I thought it was very. And I've had many people tell me of the Batman franchises, and there have been several now. that Batman Returns in the Tim Burton era was one of their favorites.
Which I
would agree. It's a different flavor than what the Christopher Nolan ones for sure.
Yeah, and you get to get punched out by Michael Keaton.
I got punched out. Yeah. Okay. So that scene, a few of us from the Red Triangle Circus Gang are throwing bricks through windows and just trashing downtown Gotham in this one scene, and all of a sudden Batman comes in and starts kicking ass, and he's taking all of us on one at a time. Well, he has just pulled a sword out of the sword swallower's mouth, who's confronted him, and I come running at him right after that with my long coat open and a bomb strapped to my chest. I'm going, ah! And so he punches me in the face to stop me and then takes the sword in his hand that he just pulled out of the sword swallower's mouth and slices off the straps that are holding the bomb on my chest. And then he throws the bomb down a manhole cover later to blow somebody else up. So it's like one thing after another. Really well choreographed. I worked with a few of Michael Keaton's stunt doubles as well as Michael Keaton, and he was delightful. But I did I tried to be funny. Okay, so when he was that scene was being set up, and they were kind of coaching him how to pull this sword. He had to actually pull the sword out of the sword swallower's mouth. It was all the way down his gullet into his stomach, and he had to pull the blade all the way out of this guy's mouth. And you know, I've never done that before. And neither had Michael Keaton. So I can imagine how gross that would feel to like be pulling a long piece of metal out of someone's esophagus. So he's pulling this out, and with it came this long string of drool that was like that bile or whatever that comes from the inside of your stomach. This long string, and so Michael Keaton did get grossed out, and he goes like, "Oh God!" like that during one of our trial runs. So we're all laughing and whatnot. So,
which is not a very Batmanish thing to do. I mean,
no, it's
not.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that would kind of overcome that. Yeah. So, then they reset. Then they were setting up cameras to get my angle running at him, and that was next. And so, Michael and I are standing there just quietly while they're getting ready to rehearse this next bit with us. And I said, you know, Michael, I don't know if you heard or not, they kind of rewrote this little bit here. He goes, oh, what's new? And I said that, well, since you did such a great job pulling the sword out of the sword swallower's mouth, we thought you could pull the bomb out of my navel. And I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever come up with. And he just goes, huh, and kind of looked away and then walked away. Left me standing there going, that wasn't funny. That wasn't funny, Doug. Doug, that was not funny. You stupid, stupid.
Billy Blazejowski sarcasm coming at you.
Yeah,
there, so.
Yeah. So, oh, anyway.
And so the sword coming out, that goes under special skills, right?
I would say so. I would definitely say so, yeah. That's on his resume, yeah.
Let's move on to Hellboy. Hellboy and Hellboy 2, mm-hmm. The Golden Army, Abe Sapien. You got this role. So what kind of homework did you do for this role? Did you kind of pour into the comic books? Was it all there in the screenplay? How did you immerse yourself?
Well, thank heaven Guillermo del Toro wrote the screenplay, and he was a huge fan of the Hellboy comic books, and he and Mike Mignola were in cahoots with each other as well. Mike Mignola was on set even for consultation a lot during both movies. So so the script of the film itself gave an awful lot. All of Guillermo's scripts inform you of most everything you need to know. With my script, though, he gave me a few graphic novels to catch up because I was not familiar with the Hellboy comic book series at that time. So I read up and saw the relationship between Abe and Hellboy and what this BPRD team was all about. And like, oh, I get it. And what I love the added movie version of Abe, though, with the clairvoyance in his hands. I like that being an extra little thing that I got to do in the live action version.
Were you kind of flipping through the comic books like, what is this? And they're like, no, that's it's all brand new.
it's exactly.
Not going to be in there.
It's not going to be in there. It's fine. Yeah. And I get a lot of information about how to play a character from the artwork I see too. The posturing and the action that you can piece together from one frame to another in a comic book helps inform my body of what to do with the character. Helps me come up with my own stuff.
Now, did this role come to you because they had they were putting together some of the pre-production art and it was mm-hmm. like oh mm-hmm.
exactly
this yeah. is the guy.
That's what happened. The conceptual art that the translation of the conceptual art from the comic book version to what the movie version would look like then turns into a sculpture with a little maquette that's a mini size version of what the character is going to look like, and so that had been done, and at the shop was Spectral Motion, headed up by Mike Elizalde in Burbank. The sculptor who did it was Jose Fernandez. It's somebody I've worked with before. And the conceptual artist who designed the Abe Sapien movie version look was Steve Wang. So those three people were about to present this maquette to Guillermo del Toro for the first day. Guillermo came in to approve this final design of Abe Sapien at the Creature Shop. So he comes into Spectral Motion, and legend has it they unveil the sculpture to him. He gasps, falls to his knees, and he says, "Oh, I am so fat," which we think means what a beautiful thin creature you've made here. Yeah. So what came with that moment was, was those three guys from Spectral Motion saying the perfect person to play this is Doug Jones. And Guillermo said, "Doug Jones, wait, I know Doug Jones." And he pulled my card out of his wallet that I gave him 5 years earlier when we met each other on Mimic, his first American studio film.
Wow.
I played one of his Long John characters in that. So
nice contact to have made.
You know what I'm saying? And a lesson for all of us, carry a card with you.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah. Stay top of mind with these people. It's worked out kind of pretty well for you. You've done several movies.
I love that man. He's my favorite director I've ever worked with in my life. And every other director knows that. And no one feels competitive because he's a genius. He's a director that all other directors love and admire.
What special skill set do you go to play a humanoid amphibian type mm-hmm. creature? I mean, where do you, you can put your hand behind your head and leg behind your head all day long, but it's like, how do you become a human fish?
Yeah.
Basically.
Right. Well, it's a couple things. With Guillermo, you read his script, you get a lot of information from that. You see what action's required of you, and you see how you fit in the team. You have a consultation with your director, and he'll tell you what physical quirks or what personality quirks he wants to see with the character. With us, it was like very short conversation. I was at one of my test fittings for Abe Sapien for the makeup, and I was in for several test fittings as they would create one piece at a time and then bring me in for a fitting to see, does the headpiece work? Does the neck blend in well with it? How are the arms doing? The webbing under the arms, how does that hook in? So I was back and forth to the Creature Shop a lot in the months of pre-production. One of those visits, I was wearing like the top half of Abe, and it hadn't been painted yet, so it was all still like, sort of an off-white latex foam rubber, fresh off the mold kind of a look. And I was wearing some pieces, and I was looking at myself in a full-length mirror through the little pinholes in the mask. I couldn't see much, and I was kind of doing like, let's see, I was kind of mimicking the fish in my tank at home. I had goldfish in my office. And the reason I had goldfish in my office was because they're tranquil and they offer peace when you look at them. And the way their heads sort of dart around and then their bodies kind of flow behind with that very, very fluid, fin-like, catching the water, pulsating motion. I wanted to incorporate that in Abe's look and in his physical demeanor. So I'm looking at myself in the mirror and kind of practicing that with this shape on me, with the head dart and then doing something like light and airy with my hands and flowy. And then all of a sudden I heard Guillermo's voice from across the room going, "That! I like that! Keep that in it!" And I didn't even know he was there that day. So I look around going, "Oh, hi, Guillermo. Yeah, okay, thanks." And we never discussed Abe's physicality ever since then. in over the course of two films. So
mental note, and
mental note, and there we go.
Running.
So yeah, so that's he's one of those directors that just gives you the shorthand, and we relate to each other very easily and very well.
Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, one of the classic roles of all time, and one of Stan Lee's favorite characters. Did you ever get a chance to talk to Stan Lee about it? What did he think of your performance?
I had read somewhere that in one of his interviews that he the Silver Surfer was his favorite character he ever created, and he reiterated that when from the stage when we were at a film festival, and they asked me to come and present him with a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Wow!
So I got I got up
no pressure.
No pressure at all. My gosh! So I had the pleasure of presenting him, and I looked back through some of his quotes and things, and I looked back through some Silver Surfer dialogue from the comic books that Stan Lee had written himself, and I used some key moments from his dialogue that he'd written so poetically and so beautifully.
Philosophical language.
Absolutely, kind of, yeah. Absolutely. I used some of those quotes when I presented this award to him on stage, and Stan Lee reiterated that night that the Silver Surfer was his favorite character he ever created because that was the character he could most speak through about the human condition, about Earth and what we've done to it, and he could wax poetic all he wanted through the Silver Surfer because he was so ethereal and so. And he was angelic and kind of Christ-like, and observed humans and had a lot to say about them and a lot of opinions about them. But he was very, very forthcoming with his opinions, but he was also very gentle in his touch. So Stan just really took to the Surfer and loved him and loved talking through him.
Oh, that had to be an amazing thrill to be able to do that, too.
Oh, gosh, indeed. Yeah, so, yeah, that was an amazing night for me.
What was the homework that you did when you got the role of the Silver Surfer?
Oh, gosh, right. Another one, yeah.
Again, fun homework. It's not homework.
No, it totally is, right.
Back to I
went to a comic book store. I went to a comic book store, and I said, I'm in my 40s, and I should have grown up with these comic books, reading them every day. I didn't. I watched the Fantastic Four cartoons on TV, and I saw a couple of comic books here and there. Again, like I watched television, a few episodes here and there, I saw comic books the same way. A few copies here and there, but I never really followed stories from start to finish. So I said, I really need to go back and bone up on the Silver Surfer. How was he introduced? Where did he go from there? Oh, so the comic book store people are always the best.
That's all they want to hear.
They're the smartest people. Right. Yes. So they sent me home with a stack of things. They pulled things off shelves, and I got an anthology book. And so I saw where he was introduced in the Fantastic Four story, and then how he spun off and they started doing Silver Surfer standalone comics. And so it was, again, it was Stan Lee's poetic, beautiful, prose-like writing. And Jack Kirby's artwork that showed such strength and yet such ballet all at the same time.
Were you studying some of the poses from the covers?
Absolutely. Oh, we brought in a movement coach to make sure that I could. I mean, the fluidity and the ballet part, I felt very confident with. The strength is something that, as a tall, skinny guy, that I wanted to make sure I had the right posturing in moments. So we had somebody, another pair of eyes. That I could consult with during filming, and that was Terry Notary. And he and I
also worked with Brandon Routh, right?
On Superman, he did indeed on Superman Return, and what a beautiful work he did with Brandon too. So that was all laid out in front of us. We had like storyboards of suggested posing and body language for the Silver Surfer. It was a whole encyclopedia Bible of Silver Surfer body language. Taken from those comic books images, and it was so great for me to channel that character through me. Now me, I'm a very expressive person. I wave my hands around when I talk, and I make lots of facial expressions. The Surfer is so not that.
He's not putting his legs behind his head.
No, he's not. He's not doing goofy wonka wonka wonka. He doesn't need to push anything out there. If you want to hear me, here I am. I'm speaking. That should be enough. It's like, oh my gosh, okay, I gotta channel that now. So that was the biggest chore for me playing the Silver Surfer. Was
my surfboard just swallowed a missile?
Yeah.
You should listen to what I'm saying.
Right, exactly. So that's a confident guy, you know. So I had to throttle back all of my instincts of, listen to me, you guys, as I flap my hands around. Really, I'm serious. I'm talking right now. Listen.
I'm an actor. Yeah,
right, exactly. I need attention. The surfer needs no attention. He needs to impress no one. Yeah, so I had to get that into my system, and that was probably the most confident I've ever been as a person when wow. I could finally take him on. And get his posture and get his demeanor down. It was a true joy for me to play him, true honor.
We're looking at some of the behind the scenes stuff too, and it's like you see Andy Serkis do the motion capture stuff, so like full leotard and ping pong balls
right.
and things. But yours was a little different. You had a full suit. Like
I
you
did.
Basically were the surfer.
I was.
With a couple of motion. So explain right. to our listeners how that worked. Right. Because you were really on set.
Yeah, it was a combo platter of the two mediums of practical effects and visual effects brought together in as one character. When you watch the Silver Surfer movie, you'll see it looks very animated in places. That was me in a full latex foam rubber muscle suit and mask makeup that was glued down to me. As it took 2 hours to get into every day, and then spray painted, and I looked like the Silver Surfer when I walked out of that trailer every day, and it was rather impressive. I'm not gonna lie, it was the most beautiful I've ever been in my life. Great bone structure, great shoulders, great ass. It was all good. It was all there. So the Weta Digital, who gave you Gollum from Lord of the Rings, they put the After Effects over the design that I was wearing by Spectral Motion, again, the creature shop that designed that look on me. So with the digital After Effects, I had a couple of tracking dots on this makeup, a couple of orangey dots that they could track me with to put that coating over me later. And also what that bought them was the ability to do big stunt scenes like you've seen in the Spider-Man movies. You know, when Tobey Maguire puts his mask on and goes flying between buildings, you see there's something different there because it was looked more a little bit more animated.
That's because it's become a video game
a little bit. Right. Well, they did that. So in my live action shots where I was standing there, you know, emoting as the Silver Surfer, and then they needed to go to cut to a stunt of me flipping through the air, they could do that rather seamlessly because of the coating that was already on me in those close-ups. So so that kind of worked. But what we aren't as aware of is when I lost my power was separated from my surfboard, which is not in the comic books, but okay, I'm just saying, the power is just in me. It's not
it's
in my board.
Movie.
I know, but yeah, again,
get over it, fanboy.
another one of those liberties that the studio takes. Okay. So when I got tarnished and lost my power and was a little bit more weakened, that I wasn't as lustrous silver. I was more brownish,
grayish,
tarnished looking.
Yeah,
tarnished. That was without the digital effects over me. The only digital effects you saw were like over my eyes to take the blue out to make it blend in more with the brownish tint. I was there, but the rest was the foam latex mask and muscle suit.
Yeah, you see them when you're being tortured.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that's
on the
really
torture table.
You. So
that's really me.
There's nothing going on.
That's
yeah.
me. That's all me.
Very
and
cool.
and the design that Spectral Motion made.
Wow.
So they do deserve an awful lot of credit for creating just a beautiful beast for me to wear on film, and all those. My favorite scene in the Silver Surfer movie was my one-on-one interaction with Jessica Alba as Sue Storm, when she kind of when she invisibled herself and got through the wall and came into my torture chamber after everybody had left. I'm strapped down to the table that's tilted up now, and we have this little exchange where she's asking me why. You know, why are you destroying our planet, and why did you protect me when that missile was flying at us? And I say to her, well, you remind me of someone, you know, my love from my own planet. And so that we have a connection there that's kind of almost slight. It edges on romantic for a minute. It was for me. Yeah, well, first of all, it's Jessica Alba, so of course it was romantic. But
if it wasn't before,
it was
going
now.
To be now.
Okay. And just the fact that the surfer hasn't been, you know, touched by anyone lovingly in who knows how long. And
well, so there's even that scene where you push her behind you.
Exactly.
And you're going to take
was,
on whatever.
Which is before this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
right, exactly.
I mean, so it combined those two scenes, and it's like, okay, there's some depth.
There's something, yeah, some depth something to it. Right. So, and I think that was Jessica's best scene, watching her as an actress in that whole movie. I thought that was her shining moment, was when she was dealing with me one-on-one in that scene. I really love that chemistry that we had on film.
They talked about a Silver Surfer standalone movie.
They did indeed.
That.
I was contracted for three films.
Okay.
So there was the chance. There was the hope that it would, his own franchise would begin.
Okay. They're rebooting it now. Rebooting. Where does all this stand? Are
you
they?
You know what? I'm and now I've become the wrong person to ask, unfortunately, okay. Because I'm so far out of the loop now.
No one's coming to you and saying, "Hey, we're just hang on. Mm. We were going to reboot this, but in the second or third one, you're coming back."
No. No one said anything to me about
that.
Your board
came to you at the end.
My board came to me. Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. If you watch through the credits, you'll see my eyes flickered open. I'm not dead. That was the hope. I'm not sure why the scripts were written.
Jay Michael Straczynski
wrote a script, and I don't know what happened with the approvals on that or why not. I'm the last person that would have heard the whys.
You're on board though.
I was on board.
No pun intended, but
I was on board, absolutely.
Okay. Now they come to you and you're like, hey, three, you're good.
If I could revisit playing that character again, are you kidding me? Of course I would. But
classic.
But if they're in reboot mode, I would not be surprised if they reboot who they're cast for the Silver Surfer again. And they may create him 100% CG next time. Who knows? Who knows if they need a person in the mix at all? So it's all up in the air.
We want you in it.
Well, you bless you. I would love to be.
How important to your career was My Name Is Jerry?
Oh, so way important. My Name Is Jerry was a chance for me to I played characters with my own face without rubber makeups on them many times over the years. I've been acting for 28 years now, and what I'm known for is the characters with heavy makeups on. But I've been guest starring on things and doing commercials and doing little smaller parts in movies with my own face for many years. But My Name Is Jerry was a low budget indie film that was created just for me to star in as the title character of Jerry. Well, no one's ever done that for me before.
This is all you.
All me. It's just me, a middle aged white guy going through a midlife crisis. Very charming story. I love the script. And the director Morgan Mead, who was the original story by person, with his friend Andy Janik, and then they brought in writer. David Hamilton later, they all created this My Name Is Jerry world for me to play in, based on knowing me and knowing my quirks and knowing my timing and my whatever comedic skills and whatever dramatic skills. They really wanted to play up, make a Doug Jones movie, which I was so very touched by, because nobody writes leading roles for tall, skinny, goofy sidekick character actors. You're right, exactly. So here I was, now the star and centerpiece of this movie, this story. So that was really very, very important for me as an actor to prove to myself that I could do it, and to give the fanboys who know me under rubber a giggly chance to see me play an entire movie with my own face. So
well, and to show producers and directors that, look, I can do all the CGI stuff, but look at this.
Yeah.
I'm not just
So if anyone's curious now about My Name Is Jerry, you can find that if you go to Amazon, you'll find the DVDs, and if you go to Hulu, you'll find it there for free. You might play with commercials or Hulu Plus, I'm sure. But if you go to Hulu, type in My Name Is Jerry, you'll find it.
More movies like that? I mean, are we looking?
I've done a ton of more now.
Those are starting to come in now. So really, was a nice little stepping
stone. It was a nice little
stepping stone. At a certain later point in your career, which is kind of cool.
Absolutely.
Too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for that to happen I was in my late 40s. I was 48 when we made My Name Is Jerry. I'm 53 now. And I did not expect, my career to blossom and bloom further as I got into this stage of age. Yeah, I didn't expect that to happen. So it's been a nice turn of events for me.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. But you're not straying too far from sci-fi. Falling Skies, Cochise. What's Cochise's full name?
Oh, this is a toughie.
And go.
And Chichok Ilsichnich Chatikol. Yes.
Very nice.
That is
my
name.
You got that down. So what can fans look forward to? Season 4 is coming up.
It is.
June 22nd.
Right.
What can we expect?
Right. Sunday nights on TNT at 10 o'clock, June 22nd. You will see the second mass going through hell all over again. Just at the end of season 3, it's like, oh, there's some hope. There's we won this battle for now. And my character, Cochise, is a member of the Volm race. And we're the good aliens who are here to fight off the bad aliens and help the humans on their quest of freedom. And at the end of season 3, it's like, oh, well, let's come together. The Volm mothership has landed with all its gun power and all its technology and know-how. Wait, hey, it might be over soon. Well, season four opens up, and in the first 5 minutes, wait till you see the season opener. In the first 5 minutes, the second mass is like, what? Boom, dum, gee, bleep, bleep. And they are like, all of a sudden, you at home are going to be cupping your face going, can't these people get a break?
Wow.
Yeah. So
right off the bat, they're not right messing around.
Not messing around. So then it jumps ahead about 4 months, and you'll see that a lot of the characters you've come to know on the show are now isolated from each other in captivity. And where are the Volm? Where is Cochise is the big question. And so I do make a visit to Tom Mason's Tom Mason, played by Noah Wiley, and I explained to him where we've been, and he's like, "Yeah, fine time to show up now. We're all in trouble. Yeah, you're supposed to be protecting us, Jack." He didn't say that, but yeah, that's what he meant. And
it's an early version of the story.
Exactly. So, but I explained to him that we, the Volm, have had other battles to fight around the universe. The Ishveni are everywhere, and we've been following them around for centuries. And they did this to our planet, so we've been liberating other planets as they've done it around the world. And if they do anything to endanger our people, wherever we're keeping them on other planets and other solar systems, other galaxies, we have to fly off and defend our own people. So we had to do that. In the middle of Earthlings' problems, we had our own to deal with. So we had to abandon them for a minute. And during that time is when all hell broke loose. So my character, Cochise, and just a few Volm soldiers have stayed on Earth. We're a small reconnaissance team that has stayed to report back to the mothership, but the mothership is way far away now. So most of season four is done without the Volm help. I'm here to answer questions. I'm here to offer advice, but I don't have a whole lot of technology to offer them right now. Yeah, so that's how we start. So it's going to be a very exciting season. Also at the end of season three, Tom Mason and Anne, Dr. Anne, played by Moon Bloodgood, had a baby, and that baby, there's some questions about that baby because it's been maturing really fast. It started talking after the first month and walking after a few weeks. It's like, wait, what the heck? So baby has some alien DNA in it, and so as season four opens up, you'll see how far she's come now. She's been growing quite a bit.
Over the past few
years. Yes, she has.
A lot of unanswered questions, a lot of time has passed.
Right. And there's even a like a Nazi youth camp throwback in here, where some of the kids on the show are held in captivity too, but it's more of a Nazi sort of esque training camp.
Like Shades of V a little bit, maybe.
Kind of, yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
Kind of a little inspired. So if you like V, you're going to.
Right, yeah. So there's a lot for everybody on it. Nice. Falling Skies has a very varied cast of ages and types. So there's someone on the show for everyone to relate to.
And Steven Spielberg's shadow behind it all.
He is indeed.
Guiding and directing.
Yeah, his thumbprint's on it. And it's a very quality show. It's very movie-esque, very cinematic.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Drop some news for us. Hellboy 3?
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, that's the number one.
Is your contract on you there?
No.
All right.
The number one question I get asked is, will there be a Hellboy 3? And I, again, I'm not the one that has the answers to that, except that when I ask the question of the powers that be, what I get is, from Guillermo del Toro especially, he would love to do a Hellboy 3, he says, but he would also love to have a full budget this time instead of working with the studios that have given him somewhat of a budget before, but he's had to scrimp and save and make the dollars stretch. He would like to have $150 million to make a Hellboy 3. So if anyone has $150 million, because the Universal Pictures is not coughing it up. So
you get a producer credit on the
Yeah, exactly.
$150
but that's
million
a big Kickstarter campaign.
That is.
Yeah. So
we'll get it going.
But Ron Perlman, Selma Blair, and I would all absolutely love to return to our roles. All of us would love to.
Frankenstein? Anything?
No word on that. No. Yet? Yeah. Another Del Toro film.
He still has your card, right?
So that's my card. Yes, I asked him about that as well. What do I tell people when they ask me about Frankenstein that you announced 8 years ago? And
announced that you would be in it.
That I would
like
be right.
Cumberbatch, and he's like, oh, you know, okay, is he going to play Dr. Frankenstein and you're the monster? What are we going
right,
on?
Right, yeah.
Conan the Silver Surfer.
Right. I'm attached to play Frankenstein's monster. And he told me that that's still underway. It's still in pre-production at Universal Pictures, development stage at Universal Pictures. But it's a matter of him writing the script word for word. He's got the ideas, the synopsis, all that is there. But he needs to sit down and type. lot of pressure on him, though, because when Guillermo del Toro says, I'm going to make Frankenstein, the reaction immediately is, oh, my gosh, that's going to be amazing. So he's got that breathing down on him while he starts to type. So I couldn't type on – I couldn't write under that kind of pressure.
Shades of De Niro.
Exactly. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? So I don't blame him for being a little gun-shy at the moment. You know, so in the meantime –
Benedict as Dr. Frankenstein possibly, or at least that's thrown out there?
There was talk, yes. I would love for that to happen for sure. I love Benedict. But in the meantime, I just did Crimson Peak with Guillermo del Toro. That's his newest, latest picture that is just – it's wrapping this month sometime. My part's done already. It's a Victorian-era haunted house story. It takes place in Boston and England. Albany? Anyway, somewhere in the East Coast America at that era. And then our main character travels over to England.
Look forward to that this year?
Look forward to that in October of 2015.
Okay. So you just wrapped on it?
I just wrapped, yeah.
Your part. Oh, so they're still shooting. Okay.
They're still shooting, yeah.
Got it.
And,
okay.
And it's a huge production. They're going to require a lot of effects and so it's going to take a while. And it needs to come out during Halloween season. Yeah, it's a haunted house story. So, and all I'm allowed to tell you is it's a haunted house story. Guess what I'm going to play. Okay. Yeah, that's all I can tell you.
Man of a thousand faces.
That's right.
That's what we got. So fans can find out about all these things on your website.
TheDougJonesExperience.com.
You're on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook.
You answer people.
I do my best. I do my best. Yeah.
You're very good. I mean, even in the line at Free Comic Book Day, and then I'm going on Facebook, and you're like talking to people, and I'm like, this is amazing.
Well, you're very kind. The key search word for all those medias, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, is Actor Doug Jones. If you want to do a search for Actor Doug Jones, you'll find the right Doug Jones.
And we'll put the links up on Comic Book Central as well. Well, it's been a real treat talking to you today. I really appreciate this. And, you know, after Free Comic Book Day, what better way to talk to the Silver Surfer and all these guys. So, Doug Jones, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining me on Comic Book Central today.
Thank you.
Come on, Hollywood executives. A Plastic Man feature film starring Doug Jones. That seems like a no-brainer to me. I'd be first in line on that one. My thanks to the wonderful and talented Doug Jones for spending some time with me. He is truly one of the nicest individuals you will ever meet. If you have a chance to catch up with him in person at one of his appearances, do yourself a favor. Go get yourself a Doug hug. I got two of them. I highly recommend them. Find out where you can meet Doug at his website, thedougjonesexperience.com. There's a link for his appearances there. You can also give Doug a like on Facebook and follow him on Twitter at @ActorDougJones. And be sure to tune in for Falling Skies' fourth season premiere, June 22nd on TNT. Doug is all over the interwebby, and so is Comic Book Central. Keep up with Comic Book Central online at comicbookcentral.net. You don't want to miss any of these amazing conversations with folks like the Silver Surfer's co-creator, Stan Lee, the entire cast of the original Fantastic Four film, Lois and Clark's Clark, Dean Cain, The Incredible Hulk, Lou Ferrigno, Catwoman, Julie Newmar, Thor's Jamie Alexander, Batman, Kevin Conroy, and many, many more. They're bringing comic books to life, and they're all here on Comic Book Central. If you don't want to miss an episode, and trust me, folks, you don't. There's a lot of great interviews coming up on the horizon. Subscribe to the show in iTunes. Please rate and review the show while you're there. I really appreciate that. Thanks to all those who have posted a review. You are very kind, and I'm glad you're enjoying the show. Be sure to hashtag share the lair on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook.com/ComicBookCentralNetwork and Twitter @ComicBookCTRL. And I want to hear from you. Drop me a line and let me know what you think of the show. joe@comicbookcentral.net. Hey, Virtual Willie Lumpkin dropped by the lair to deliver a Facebook note from listener Dana Greenlee, who writes, I very much enjoyed listening to your interview with Mark Daly. Your knowledge of Human Target and comparisons to Person of Interest was fantastic. The conversation was engaging and authentic and full of great stories. Oh, thank you for the kind words, Dana. Really appreciate it. Mark is a great storyteller. Always a plus when a guest stops by the lair. And I love Person of Interest. It's kind of like the continuation of Human Target that we never really got. And who knows, maybe Mark will pitch the idea of a Human Target movie and we will get a chance to see the ongoing adventures of Christopher Chance and the rest of the gang. Hey, thanks for writing in. And I also want to thank the guys over at the Simply Superman Batman podcast, Sam Rizzo and Adam Bassiano for having me on as a guest on the show recently. The link to that episode is on the Comic Book Central Facebook page and Twitter feed. I'll post the link on the show notes on the Comic Book Central website as well. Be sure to check it out and give those guys a like and subscribe on iTunes. It's part of the Schuster Herald podcast. Hey, with so much going on in the world of Superman and Batman these days, these guys have a lot to talk about, so check them out. Well, just like Stan Lee signing Excelsior at the end of a Marvel soapbox, I am signing off for today. My thanks again to the incredibly talented Doug Jones for spending some time with me on Free Comic Book Day and for sharing some amazing stories with us. Next week on Comic Book Central, Brown Coats Unite! He soared through space packing a Callahan full-bore autolock he nicknamed Vera. And he was the hero of Canton, the man they call Jane. Adam Baldwin will be here to talk about Firefly, Serenity, portraying John Casey from Chuck, and throwing down with Doomsday as the Man of Steel in Superman Doomsday. A lot of comic talk coming up with Adam. Until then, have a marvelous week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Oh, I get the hug from Doug.
Yeah. Oh, hello. You thought you were immune.